Een maatschappij waarin iedereen meedoet. Een gezonde, groene en rechtvaardige wereld. Daar willen jij en heel veel andere mensen best iets aan bijdragen. In het klein en in het groot. Dicht bij huis en ver weg. Zo hebben we vorig jaar 349 miljoen euro bij elkaar gebracht. Miljoenen waarmee onze goede doelenpartners de wereld elke dag een beetje beter kunnen maken. Nationale Postcode Loterij. Samen voor een betere wereld.
Nieuw Aquarius Red Peach Zero Sugar. Met zijn heerlijke frisse perziksmaak zonder suiker draagt Aquarius bij tot jouw dagelijkse hydratatie en helpt zo mee om je vochtbalans op peil te houden tijdens alledaagse, actieve momenten. Thuis, op het werk of onderweg. Ook verkrijgbaar in smaken lemon en orange. Probeer hem nu.
Hoi, Wouter hier van Future Affairs. Voor NRC doken filosoof Jessica van der Schalk en ik eerder al in het mysterie van bewustzijn. En die grote vraag die laat ons maar niet los. Hoe kan het dat een willekeurige collectie deeltjes zoals een mens überhaupt iets ervaart? Hoe kan het dat het als iets voelt om mij te zijn? Dat zijn eeuwige vragen, maar ook een vraag waarover de inzichten in hersenwetenschap, filosofie en de natuurkunde nog steeds flink aan het verschuiven zijn. We hadden laatst een erg interessant gesprek op Brainwash Festival in Amsterdam. Precies over dat mysterie. En dat was een gesprek dat we jou als luisteraar niet willen onthouden. We interviewden Peter Sjöstedt-Hughes, een Brits-Zweedse filosoof die werkt aan en met psychedelica. Eén worden met de natuur, samensmelten met de kosmos, iets ervaren buiten ruimte en tijd. Dat zijn de ervaringen die veel mensen hebben als ze die middelen gebruiken. Maar wat nou als die trippy ervaringen iets laten zien over de werkelijkheid in ons bewustzijn? Daar hadden we ook nog wel wat vragen bij natuurlijk. En Peter is nogal een tornado van een spreker. Hij doet het in het Engels. Dus hou je vast voor deze live bonusaflevering van Future Affairs. Het mysterie van bewustzijn.
Thank you. Are you conscious right now? Ask yourself. Are we having the same experience right now?
Don't worry. We're not at a meditation session. We're at Brainwash Festival. We're talking about the mystery of consciousness combined with another mystery, I would say, psychedelics.
Yes.
Right? My name is Wouter van Noort. I work for NRC. I write about the future, which basically means I have the best job, I think. I can write about anything. It's a blank slate. I can write about ecology, technology, complexity. And we made a nice little podcast series called Future Affairs as well, about the mystery of consciousness, right?
Exactly, yeah. We made... I'm Jessica van der Schalk. I'm a philosopher. Philosophy of mind is one of my favorite topics. And we made a podcast, yeah, with 5 episodes about consciousness. And for me, we talked with a lot of great people, interesting neurologists, etc. But what stood out for me was during the weeks we made the podcast, I was so self-aware of being conscious all the time. I couldn't escape it. I am conscious all the time. And of course, when you're not conscious, maybe when you're sleeping, but you don't notice that. So the consciousness is undeniable, and that stood out for me.
And that became apparent, right? And it's quite telling for our difference. My experience of making the podcast was a bit more cognitive, I think, but not less impressive, actually. For me, it changed my mind about consciousness. I started out as, one would say, a hardcore materialist, someone who believes that our consciousness, our awareness, is most probably a product of electricity, matter in the mind, that mind is fundamentally material. But it led me to doubt that and to see the mystery in this question, because we talk to quantum physicists who have things to say about consciousness. We talk to philosophers, to neurologists, and explanations that sounded really weird to me before, like maybe everything around us is conscious, maybe the cosmos is conscious, maybe you can breathe consciousness through the cosmos. Things that I would have put in the basket of strange new age thinking, not taken too seriously before, actually became more apparent, and I think we should talk about them more. And
we should, and psychedelics is, as a philosopher, very interesting, because through our consciousness we experience reality. So our consciousness is crucial to know anything about reality. But during our podcast, we also talked about psychedelics and the experiences you can have. They are so strange, and you know, you can experience a contradiction. You can feel one with the world and forget your individuality. So as a philosopher, it's interesting to know, can we, what's the truth value of these experiences?
Is anybody in the room willing to raise their hand to tell if they had an experience on psychedelics? I bet there are a bit more. But let me, can I see the raise of hands to just get a, it's like a quarter of the people, maybe a third, or is it more?
Yeah.
Is anybody willing to talk about their experience and their relationship to consciousness?
That's, you're a coward. You should talk about it. Oh, what's your experience?
Okay, well, we'll go to the audience later.
Yes,
right?
We will.
I did have, I think I had three. I know I had three. I get shy now. I had three experiences, very mixed, actually. The first one I wouldn't recommend to anybody. Very fearful, very disconnected, lonely, dark, maybe a bad trip on LSD it was. But the two experiences after that were wonderful. Mystical, you could call them. A sense of oneness with nature, surroundings, maybe even the cosmos. Really strange for me to experience as a hardcore materialist, right? There's still a sort of skeptic voice in my head that this could all still be a hallucination. That this is induced by the stuff that I ingested, and the stuff is material after all. But I think we should delve into this question, and I'm really happy with the guest that we have for you today, Peter Sjöstedt-Hughes. He combines philosophy of mind and research in psychedelics, talks about metaphysics, teaches at Exeter University, and really he will take us into the world of Spinoza and ayahuasca, Nietzsche and magic mushrooms. So please give him a warm welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Wouter, Jessica. Thanks for the brainwash organizers, and thanks to you for coming. I'm delighted to be here. Right, so I've got 40 slides to give you in 10 minutes, so it's going to be fast. But we've got questions at the end, haven't we? Okay, so it's called Altered Modes of Mind and the Mind-Matter Mystery. So basically the combination of philosophy of mind or metaphysics of mind and psychedelics, what I research at the University of Exeter in Britain. Plan is this. Psychedelics open up the mind-matter mystery, the hard problem of consciousness. Then we'll look at the responses to that, metaphysics of mind. Then I'll give you some examples of psychedelic-induced metaphysical experiences. I'll quickly tell you about metaphysical integration and psychedelic therapy, and then just a little bit about my projects and work at the moment. Right, so yeah, psychedelics open up the mind-matter mystery. What is the mind-matter mystery, you may ask? Well, it's also known as hard problem of consciousness. It's not exactly the same, but more or less. David Chalmers coined this phrase in 1995, but it's an old philosophical problem going back thousands of years. And it's basically this, the hard problem, quote from Chalmers. The hard problem, why is all this physiological processing accompanied by an experienced inner life? A solution to this problem may profoundly affect our conception of the universe and of ourselves. In other words, end quote, in other words, it will profoundly affect our metaphysical viewpoint, the solution to the mind-matter mystery. And it's no good simply just thinking that we can discover this by looking at the brain alone. As the great philosopher of mind, Jae-Gwon Kim, who died a couple of years ago, said, quote, making a running list of psychoneural correlations does not come anywhere near to gaining an explanatory insight into why there are such correlations. So brain science basically presents the problem, does not solve it. So what is the solution? Well, I don't know the solution to the problem, I'm afraid, but I can give you a menu of options which relate to psychedelic experiences, interestingly. So this is not exhaustive. There are many other options than this. But generally, when I talk about the mind, people think either you're a materialist or you're a dualist. But there are many other options. So for example, this is the concept mind and matter. Maybe they're the same thing, but we have different concepts at least. So substance dualism is one way of looking at that, the solution to the mind-matter mystery, that mind and matter are distinct substances. So when your body dies, your soul still exists, so maybe it existed before you were born. Descartes, famous for that, Plato. Eliminativism in the 20th century, some people thought, you know what, consciousness is such a problem, we just get rid of it, we'll eliminate it. It doesn't exist, and everyone's like, great, we can get on with the science. Unfortunately, that led to a number of paradoxes, the belief that there are no beliefs, for example. Epiphenomenalism, I've practiced that many years now, I can say it. Epiphenomenalism, quite a beautiful word, really, isn't it? It means that the brain produces the mind, but the mind has no effect backwards. So no free will, no mental causation. Your desire for a beer has no effect on your body whatsoever. It was famously proposed by Aldous Huxley's grandfather, Thomas Huxley. Emergentism is probably the common viewpoint today among scientists, I would say, and it's the view that the brain produces the mind, or generates the mind emerges from the brain. But also, you see the arrow going down, there is some mental causation, because without mental causation, you run into this problem with evolution. Why did we evolve mentality if it has absolutely no power at all? Not just humans, but presumably many different creatures. In the 1950s, 60s, psychoneural identity theory was quite common. That's just the view that the brain is the mind. It's not that the mind emerges from the brain, it's rather that they are the same thing. There was a problem regarding octopuses with this, so people moved on. I've only got 10 minutes, right? So, panpsychism, I did my PhD on panpsychism, it's doing the rounds today. You know, we've sort of come to a cul-de-sac, like a stop with our understanding of what consciousness could be and how it relates to nature. So we've gone back and we've looked at panpsychism, which is the view that it's not that the brain is identical to the mind, it's rather that all matter is identical to mind. Idealism, big in Germany to start with, with Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, maybe, so on. It made its way to British idealism. It's the view that mind is the fundamental substance and that produces what we understand as matter. And then neutral monism, which is rather the fundamental substance of reality, that which everything's made of, is neither mind nor matter. Rather, mind and matter are both expressions or attributes of that one substance. Albert Hofmann, who synthesized LSD, in 1943 he took it for the first time, much too high a dose. But anyway, that's another story. But anyway, in this book, LSD, My Problem Child, he starts the last chapter with the epigraph from Goethe, which reads, "What more can a person gain in life than that God nature reveals himself to him?" That's Goethe referring to a great Amsterdam philosopher, Benedictus Spinoza. I just went to this Spinoza statue today, actually, before I came here. Pretty amazing. Spinoza was a kind of neutral monist. Neutral monism is the view that mind and matter are the same thing, but also, and this is what got him into trouble, he's a pantheist, he thought God and nature are also the same thing, and he's a monist because it's one substance, God and nature. We can talk about that later if you like. If you're interested in that, I've written a chapter on Spinoza's philosophy in relation to the psychedelic 5-MeO-DMT, which is the strongest psychedelic I've ever taken, and I think the strongest... I decided before I came on, I'll admit it, you know. But I only took it once, it's so powerful. Anyway, if you're interested, read that book. And also, I should say, there's the transcendent realm, so Plato, for example, but also people like Kurt Gödel, logicians, Frege, Bertrand Russell, early on in life at least, Whitehead, people like that believe that there's another realm of existence, which is where, for example, mathematical truths, logical truths in here, also perhaps beauty, justice, truth, things like this. Anyway, so there's just a small selection of answers to the mind-matter mystery. And there's no escape from that. As Whitehead said, quote, "If you don't go into metaphysics, you assume an uncritical metaphysics," end quote. So if you don't think about this, you just assume what is normal in your culture, and your ideology, because all cultures, all ideologies have a metaphysics. Most people are unaware of it, of course. How it relates to psychedelics, more now. Well, the mind-matter mystery we don't know the answer. No one agrees upon an answer. A lot of people think, oh, obviously the answer is this, but they don't get agreement. It's an open question. So the mind-matter mystery keeps the metaphysical options open for interpreting psychedelic experience. So let's say, for example, you have an experience, like you said, of being one with the universe. You know, was that a delusion, hallucination? You can only say what a hallucination is if you know what reality is, and we don't know what reality is, or maybe some people know, but we can't agree on it anyway. And interestingly, Humphrey Osmond, who coined the term psychedelics in 1956-57, he wrote this in the very paper where it was first published. Perhaps most important, there are social, philosophical, and religious implications in the discoveries made by means of these agents. So there you have it. In the 50s, there was this, whilst defining the agent, the substance itself, he was talking about the philosophical implications. Also, he mentioned thinkers like William James, Kant, Henry Bergson, and others. How am I doing for time? Okay, 5 minutes, right. Okay, it's all good? All right. So, let me give you some examples of psychedelic-induced metaphysical experiences. First, though, I want to point out that, of course, not all psychedelic experience is metaphysical. Not all of it is mystical. Some of it is. But sometimes psychedelic experience can just be about having a laugh or becoming a better hunter, like in the Americas, locating a lost object, feeling your body in different ways, becoming a piano, whatever, right? mysticism, it's, you know, can be doctrinal, you know, like St. Teresa of Avila was Roman Catholic. A lot of her writings don't really relate to the experience. Metaphysics can be very dry and dull. I mean, I love it, but a lot of people think it's boring, like grammar. Like, what is identity? What is necessity? What is it? What is a cause, you know? I teach this as well. But anyway, so they're not exactly the same thing, but in the middle, they do meet, interestingly. Benny Shannon, who wrote this book in 2002, 20 years ago, 21 years ago, The Antipodes of the Mind, Charting the Phenomenology of the Ayahuasca Experience, which is seen as like a seminal book, really, in psychedelics, Oxford University Press. He writes this: overall, ayahuasca, which is, if you don't know, a Brazilian brew, a drink that you ingest, it has DMT and a number of other psychoactive agents in it. Anyway, he writes this as a conclusion: overall, ayahuasca induces a comprehensive metaphysical view of things. I would characterize it as idealistic monism with pantheistic overturns. Interesting, interesting mixture. I'll give you some more examples now. So pantheism, that God is nature. Alan Watts, you know, the great writer in the 20th century on LSD, he writes this, quote, "The individual discovers himself to be one continuous process with God, with the universe. To those who have known it, it is as real and overwhelming as falling in love." Mm. Panpsychism. It's from a great book from 1957, I think it was, yeah, called A Drug Taker's Notes by R. M. Ward. You know, really interesting, and also from the 50s, so he's not sort of influenced by common fashions in metaphysics. He wrote this: "I realized on 100 micrograms LSD that the whole universe is made up of things which have their own natures, relationships, significances, and that in some universal scale, each thing has its proper degree of awareness." Panpsychism is linked to animism. The view that, you know, all of nature has its own spirit or mind, or, well, it's very hard to translate these terms. But anyway, my friend anthropologist Dr. Luis Eduardo Luna writes this: "It's impossible to understand Amerindian or animist culture without reference to these psychedelic plants." So the metaphysical view of animism is very much tied up with Amerindian or Native American uses of psychedelics. Getting a bit weird now. Novel qualia. Jae Gwon Kim, again, this philosopher of mind, he writes this: "Why are there just these qualia?" Qualia is like colors, sounds, smells. "Why are there just these qualia and not other possible ones? That remains a mystery." What is so fascinating with psychedelics is you do have novel qualia. In other words, colors you can't imagine, smells you can't imagine, tastes, well, maybe not tastes and smells, but also qualia that are not even within those categories. So they're not smells, they're not sounds, they're not synesthesia, something completely different. That's why they're ineffable, very hard to put into words. Entities turn up a lot, and I must admit these are, you know, still a mystery to me. Here's an example from Rex Strassman's study with DMT from one of his patients. "As I accepted my death and dissolution into God's love, the insectoids began to feed on my heart, devouring the feeling of love and surrender. They feasted as they made love to me. It was extremely alien, though not necessarily unpleasant." Nature connectedness. There's a lot of research at the moment into nature connectedness in relation to mental health. but also into how psychedelics can induce nature connectedness and thereby benefit mental health. Here's an example of extreme nature connectedness from Paul Devereux. I found my awareness slipping inside that of the daffodil. While still being conscious of sitting in a chair, I could also sense my petals. Then an exquisite sensation cascaded through me, and I knew I was experiencing light falling on those petals. It was virtually orgasmic, the haptic touch equivalent of an angelic choir. There are different levels of nature connectedness, becoming a daffodil's extreme form of it. Anyway, so there's just a few examples. I'll give you many more, but I don't have time. I've got 1 minute, okay. Is that right? Okay. Let me just tell you a little bit now about how we're using in Exeter metaphysics in therapy. So unlike most other forms of therapy, psychedelic therapy often involves metaphysical experience. But of course, psychotherapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and so on are not generally trained in metaphysics. Some are, existential psychology perhaps, but generally not. It's not in their professional ambit yet. So my conjecture is this: offering a patient an additional and optional discussion of a scheme of metaphysical perspectives, a bit like the images I showed you before, for integration may extend long-term benefits of psychedelic therapy and beyond. Okay, what I basically mean by that, let's say you go in to psychedelic therapy for depression, for example. You have a preparatory session with your therapist. You get to know them, usually a male and female, like these two. And then you take the drug. We're not doing that tonight. And then afterwards, there's an integrative session where you talk about your experiences. But let's say you had a pantheistic insight, metaphysical pantheistic insight, for example. If the integrator, therapist, doesn't know anything about pantheism, you can't really talk about it, and you can't realize that there's a long history of great thinkers who have proposed pantheism, like Amsterdam Spinoza, for example. So therefore, I think that, you know, talking about this, and you know, not in complex philosophical detail, but just the overview will may aid long-term benefits of psychedelic therapy. That's conjecture. There's no proof for it yet, but it can be tested. The primary point is this: psychedelic-induced metaphysical experiences will be more adequately comprehended and integrated with recourse to metaphysics. To me, that sounds like a tautology, in other words, something that's true by definition. But still, it's not yet done. If you're particularly interested in that, I've got a paper out, open access, on the need for metaphysics in psychedelic therapy and research. 15,000 words, a lot more details there, and footnotes. Right, 10 seconds, right? Yeah, okay, so projects and work, what am I doing now? Well, we've got, starting in January in next university, online though, so global, PG cert, a postgraduate certificate, like a small master's degree in what's called psychedelics, mind, medicine, culture, online. We're developing that with Celia Morgan, Professor Celia Morgan, who's done ketamine research for the last 10 years, Leo Roseman, who's just moved from Imperial College to join us at Exeter, Andy Letcher, who wrote The History of Magic Mushroom, Christine Hauskeller, who uses critical theory, and many others. It would be ethic, it would be basically science and social sciences. And yeah, last slide, there you go, through my three books, buy all of those. Thanks a lot for your time.
Please have a seat, have a drink if you want.
Take a breath.
Take a breath. That was a whirlwind, right?
Okay.
Wow. Some people in the audience listening to this might ask themselves, what has he been taking?
Yeah.
Yes.
What have you been taking?
Sparkling water mostly today, yeah.
Today. But you already lifted a bit of the curtain on your own experience. Mm. Can you lift the curtain up a little bit more?
Okay. I've admitted this in public already, so it's fine. How did it start? I was in London. I was teaching philosophy of religion. I got roped into that, even though I was kind of atheist materialist in my 20s. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a stab. I had to teach William James's book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, or the last chapter on mysticism, and he's one of the first to combine mysticism with drugs, nitrous oxide, ether. He even says alcohol is the beginning of the mystical consciousness stage. Anyway, it interested me because I'd never had such an experience. And then one day in Cornwall, in southwest England, where I live, my brother, who's an amateur mycologist, mushroom expert, said, "Peter, I think these are magic mushrooms here." I was like, "Oh, really? Okay." So I collected them all, like 100 or something. I've never found that many in one place ever again. And then I checked them online, and then eventually I took a large dose when I returned to London, and it was just like the most incredible experience I've ever had mentally. And
can you describe it? What made it so...
Well, it's just... aesthetically fantastic. So with eyes open, for example, the plants and paintings in my room in London were just 10 times more meaningful, significant, beautiful, different shades of colors came emphasized. And then with their closed eyes, I suddenly traveled into space, you know, like go through galaxies. I saw aliens, and I thought, okay, this is how we communicate with aliens through mushrooms, you know, forget about SETI and all that. And that I thought at the time, not now necessarily. And then I saw the devil or a demon in front of me, and then I sort of switched and became that devil.
And there was something in that experience that made you think, hey, this might be showing me reality more than I see it with my daily view.
At the time, that was an interesting question, you know, because how do you, was some of it perhaps veridical, you know, like objectively true?
Veridical as in being true.
Yeah, as in being real. So I decided to look at the literature and philosophy of mind, and there was nothing, almost, you know. There was William James, of course, and a few others since. But then I realized there was not much, relatively speaking, for good historical reasons. Not good reasons, but for historical reasons. And then I decided to give it a go myself. And a lot of people said, listen, this will destroy your career if you do this. You know, so
really?
This was, yeah. Like,
that's changed a bit.
That now, you know, I get people emailing me to do a PhD every week on it.
You can come to Amsterdam to talk about your work.
Exactly, yeah. But no, 15 years ago or so, even 10 years ago, probably it was seen as absolutely taboo. There
still seems to be a taboo on bringing in your own experiences in the science somehow.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, originally when LSD, for example, was administered by Sandoz Laboratories from Switzerland, Basel, the intention was to give the LSD to the psychiatrist so they would take it themselves to understand the patient, you know, in terms of schizophrenia and so on, you know. It wasn't given to the patient. But that changed because, you know, it obviously became illegal and... And then there was propaganda about how it sort of fries your brain and so on. And also, when that happened, interestingly, you know, like 1970, but, you know, philosophy of mind then was very reductivist. So, like I said, eliminativist. So they didn't even really believe in consciousness, let alone psychedelic consciousness. So there was just no interest, no funding. And it was illegal, of course, so... So that's why there wasn't much literature. Yeah.
Just to clear that up, you just made a differentiation between psychedelic consciousness and consciousness. Can you say, is there a difference?
Oh, there's certainly a difference, I would say. I guess, you know, the question what is consciousness is so broad anyway, and there's so many varieties, it's a really hard question.
Yeah, this was next on the
list.
That's
the next one.
Sure.
But psychedelic consciousness, I think there's just many varieties of psychedelic consciousness. Some of it is mystical. Other parts are very bodily, somatic. And it's very hard to generalize. But there are, you know, there are like mysticism questionnaires for psychedelic trials, which is based on the work of Walter Stace from 1960. So that's like criteria such as feeling oneness with nature, paradoxicality, as you mentioned.
What is paradoxicality?
Paradoxicality means an experience which breaks the axioms of logic as we understand it. There's three core axioms of logic in the West. So, for example, the experience of being both here and there at the same time, of something being green and red at the same time, existing in the past.
Transcending time and space, maybe.
Yeah, past and future coming together. So that kind of paradoxicality, which doesn't...
And that's exclusive to this psychedelic consciousness?
I'd say it's exclusive to mystical consciousness, which and psychedelic consciousness kind of overlaps with that. Yeah,
yeah.
There have been I think you can reach similar states not through drugs, but through for example, a few months ago, I went to Vermont and learnt holotropic breathwork, which I was a little bit skeptical of to start with, but it actually does work. So it's just you sort of lie down, you breathe very quickly, very heavily for about 5-10 minutes, and listen to specific music. And then, boom, you're out in a trance for 4 hours.
Yeah. Wow. So psychedelics seems to be one of the ways, but one of the most powerful ways. Like, it seems to turbocharge the mystical experience. You can get it in nature, you can get it from breathing, you can get it from meditation, but DMT, I never used it, but it seems to be something completely different than even holotropic breathwork, right?
Well, yeah. There's DMT, normal DMT, as it were, and then there's 5-MeO-DMT, which is... I took this once for academic reasons, and the reason.
Yeah, we're not advising any drug use here, of course. We're scientifically delving into it.
Yeah.
Right? That's important.
It's actually true in my case, you know, but tell the judge, right, okay. But 5-MeO-DMT was the most extreme. I took it because I wanted... I mean, a lot of my psychedelic experiences before then were very aesthetic, visionary, beautiful. But I wanted this total monist experience.
Monist as all being one, right?
All being one from Plotinus onwards. You know, Plotinus was a Neoplatonic philosopher who lived in the 3rd century AD who wrote metaphysics about the one, yeah. And that has been very influential in Western understandings of consciousness. Anyway, a friend of mine who lives in the village... next village in Cornwall where I live, he takes 5-MeO every single Sunday morning, strangely, for the last 3 years, you know. Anyway, he offered it to me, and I said, okay, let's try it. And it was just, you know, for a few weeks after taking it, I couldn't even talk about it. I was almost crying, you know, it's so intense. But it was...
But it seems to help your thinking, and it seems to be at least a part of your academic work.
Yeah.
About also maybe the nature of consciousness, right? And what would you answer if we put you on the spot now? What is consciousness?
What is consciousness? Well, I do get that question every week, so I do have an answer. And, and my answer is this. You can divide that question into three parts. You can talk about the contents of consciousness, so things like qualia, like colors, sounds, concepts, rationality, cognition, and things like time rate and memory. So it's what you actually experience. That's one answer to what's consciousness. You just give a list. Second answer is how mind is different from matter or from not mind. So for example, and now all of these answers are controversial, but for example, some people say that consciousness is private, so only I have access to my feelings and my memories and so on. You don't. You can guess, but you'd never get there. And matter is not private. Other people say... consciousness has intentionality, which means aboutness. So like in love, something is loved. In hate, something is hated. In thought, something is thought about. Whereas matter doesn't have that. Interesting, with 5-MeO-DMT, that was lost. So that kind of... there's an example of how psychedelic experience...
How exactly?
Well, there was a sense of extreme profundity after this white light. Extreme importance. I mean, I came out of it just swearing and sweating and... but for no object, you know. you don't know about what. And the experience itself seemed to get, you know, you lost all concepts, all memories, everything. You saw white light to start with, but then everything was lost. But at the same time, something remained, which was, all I can say is profundity. But that kind of, it was a form of a consciousness that kind of did not include many of the criteria answering the question. So it has interesting implications there.
And it's interesting why you think that this experience tells you anything about the nature of consciousness. You really believe that this is not just an hallucination, but this is somehow showing you something of reality itself.
Because it's not maybe the nature of consciousness, but more the nature of reality. Because I'm wondering if your consciousness... in this experience is actually different than your consciousness as we are sitting right now. So not the what, but the that. Mm. So not what we experience, that's obviously very different, but that we are conscious, is that so different? Or are these intertwined?
It is. It's very. I mean, again, with the 5-MeO-DMT, which comes from the secretions of Sonoran desert toad, or you can get a synthetic version. But anyway, yeah, it's almost like it's not even a state of experience, it's a state of existence, you know, it's so different. You can't really, almost, you can't use the word experience or consciousness. And that's where language breaks down, yeah. You know, and William James said ineffability is a key mark of the mystical
experience. Can't describe it.
Yeah, you can't describe it. Because, you know, words exist for common consciousness, prosaic consciousness.
Yeah.
They don't exist for these states. But can I just answer?
Yeah, I'm still looking for the answer to the question, what is consciousness?
Yeah, yeah. So we can talk about the contents. We can talk about how it maybe differs. Like Descartes, for example, also said that mind is completely non-spatial, matter is spatial. All of these different criteria are problematic. There's criticisms of each. So that's the second way. The third way, you can talk about how mind relates to matter. And that was like, for example, the blue and green squares and circles that I had, you know? So like, it can relate in a dualistic sense, or an emergentist sense, or an identical sense, or a neutral monist sense, and so on. So you provide those three answers. and you've answered the question, what is mind? However, all of those, as you can understand, have got criticisms. So there's no easy answer to the what is consciousness, because we don't, basically, we don't know what the exact criteria are.
Okay. Now, this is quite clear also from delving into the science and the philosophy about this, is that there is no clear answer. But what do you think? What do you think is consciousness?
What, me?
Yeah.
Well, I think that certain elements make more sense than others. So I think privacy, for example, is a good marker. But ultimately, when it comes to the relations, I do sympathize with, and I'm not a dogmatist because I realize that every single solution has problems. But I do sympathize with a neutral monism, you know, something
neutral
akin,
monism,
which was coined by Bertrand Russell, but now means something different. It's kind of akin to Spinoza's philosophy. So I'm kind of in that.
Spinoza, I know from Deus sive natura, God, or nature. Mm-hmm. God and nature are somehow one, but there is some transcendent quality to the primal consciousness.
Yeah, so Einstein's favorite philosopher was Spinoza, because he said, you know, he was the first philosopher in the modern world to bring mind and matter together. And you think, so, but, yeah.
Okay, but
this one, I'm thinking, really.
No, so
one
appreciate the complexity.
There's one substance which is God or nature. Humans have access to two expressions of that, mind and matter, or thought and extension. But there's an infinity of other ways of seeing God, but humans are not privy to that. And also, interestingly, although, of course, if the mind is the body, that means when the body dies, the mind dies. However, in the Ethics, Spinoza's masterwork, 1677, he writes, something remains after death. And then he talks about this very ambiguous concept called the intellectual love of God or nature. And he says it's beyond reason, it's kind of intuition. And
that seems to resonate with certain psychedelic experiences, right? Yeah. That there is a sort of transcendent love or compassion or a connection to nature and the cosmos.
Yeah, I would actually ask, is your monism view... We don't experience it maybe in our how we sit here. So when you sit here, maybe dualism feels more natural because, yeah, here's my body and here's my thinking. I can touch it. So that maybe psychedelics and opens the door to actually experience that philosophical position.
Yeah. Well, this is the interesting thing about it, because Deleuze, you know, the French philosopher, he wrote two books about Spinoza, and he's... one of them, the best one, the little one, called Spinoza Practical Philosophy, he writes, Spinoza can be understood through years of study, you know, and through all the complex axioms, logic, and so on that he presents, or it can be intuited in a flash, like this.
Yeah.
A flash of Spinozism.
A flash of DMT.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, so then my question was, how do you induce this flash, right? and this is partly why I took the 5-MeO. This is the chapter I wrote about. You can have, so metaphysics branches off into both intellectual metaphysics, which you learn at university and so on, and also experiential metaphysics. So that is then, interestingly, like, for example, this monist thing where you think you become one with nature.
Yeah.
And you can just stay at that level and you think, wow, that was a weird experience, but probably totally bullshit. But at the same time, you can at least seek to fortify it and substantiate it with metaphysics, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this might help in therapy. This is the sort of conjecture.
Yeah. I think it's a good time to ask the audience. Hello, do you have one more question?
No, I would just love for you to answer. Why would you call upon philosophers today to say, okay, we really need to take psychedelics seriously? What is the value that we are missing out on if we don't?
Well, I suppose in philosophy of mind, one reason is that, you know, in prosaic consciousness, there's no such thing as normal consciousness, but everyday, you know, standard consciousness is very limited. It's only a small fragment of what you can experience in the mind. So if you're doing philosophy of mind, I think, you know, it's more interesting to have a greater array of things to pick on. Also now, because we're in the so-called psychedelic renaissance in the last 10 years or so, where they, you know, we're using psychedelics in clinical trials for therapy, all of these interesting ethical questions emerge, and that's where philosophers come in again, you know, like the appropriation, patents, cognitive liberty, justification of the law, things like this. You know, these are ethical questions.
And it's interesting how there's a renaissance in psychedelics research, but also in consciousness studies somehow. They seem to be entangled, maybe.
Well, it's very lucky because, like I said, in the 60s, you know, philosophy of mind was at its most reductivist when the, you know, the sort of LSD kicked in, as it were. And so that, the sort of academics, mostly, not Timothy Leary, obviously, but most of them stayed away from it. But now, because all of the consciousness theories have kind of failed, and even in the news a few months ago, you know, integrated information theory was called a pseudoscience.
Yeah, with a lot of criticism about that. Yeah, but what I found interesting, most interesting recently, is that David Chalmers, so the philosopher posing the heart problem of consciousness, he went into a bet with a famous neuroscience professor about the question, is neuroscience going to be able to explain consciousness? And up to now, the neuroscience professor had to admit his loss. And he won a bottle of wine or something. So it's an ongoing question, of course.
Yeah.
But there's definitely some mystery to it. Questions from the audience. We have two lovely mic runners. Yeah. I would like to remind everybody that a question in my mind is not longer than 1 minute and ends with a question mark.
That goes for you, not for us, okay?
I will keep it short, maybe also related to the meta ethics thing. So if psychedelics can induce these like non-dual and meaningful experiences, like why are we not so by nature? So why does the human have to take these substances in order to experience this? So why are we not like, why are we not unified by default, but do we need these substances?
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating question. I mean, arguably some people are attuned to these other insights, maybe the so-called nature mystics, people like Wordsworth, you know, Blake and so on. You know, that's one thing, but they're a minority, obviously. Bergson, Henri Bergson, who's a friend of William James, and he was referenced by Aldous Huxley in The Doors of Perception, his argument is that we have evolved a specific type of human consciousness for practical reasons. So what we perceive is what is good for our survival and for our evolutionary survival. But of course, you know, we know that we only perceive a fragment of reality. You know, we don't see even infrared or ultraviolet. So we know that our consciousness is very limited, and we can understand that in evolutionary terms. So if there is more to consciousness than simply human brains, and Descartes thought consciousness was only limited to humans, not even other mammals, then we should be receptive to it, I think, you know, because, you know, there's scientific reasons for our limited perception.
Yeah, we evolved limited perception because it serves us and our survival, not because evolution is not by definition geared towards understanding reality, you say, right?
Well, I think so. Yeah.
Another question.
Up on a...
Can I see some hands? Right there.
I dabbled a bit in shamanism and aura reading, and in both instances, I had experiences, and one of the shamanism experiences was that I was able to go into the sort of mind of my plant in the corner of my room and observe what the plant was actually thinking or was experiencing of the objects in my room. And that's a sort of psychedelic experience. Are you interested in that sort of experiences, also with aura reading, when you feel something that happened in somebody's life and they can confirm that it did happen? They are psychedelic in a way,
aren't they? And sensing the inner world of a plant could be monist as well, right? If everything is one, then the plant and your mind could also be one.
I wonder what the plant was thinking about this.
Yeah.
but seriously, though, no, I am interested in that because, like I said, types of neutral monism, like Spinoza's, they allow for consciousness in plants. And we shouldn't think that consciousness is a necessary product of neural activity only. There's no proof for that at all. This is an assumption. I mean, if you believe that machines can become conscious, you have to rule that out for a start. I sympathize with basic, like the ancient Greeks and like most Europeans until the 17th century, I'd think that plants are basic forms of consciousness. They don't think what they did last night with their friends, obviously, but they maybe appreciate water and sunlight, something like this. And psychedelics seem to open up experiences of that. And not only in the West, but, you know, like I said, in the Americas, you know, there's the belief that all plants really have forms of spirit. So there's a lot more research to be done on that. There's also a science now called something like plant neurobiology. It's a misnomer. But there's a lot of interesting evidence coming out that plants can remember things and have preferences and can even hear.
Well, and if you go into the soil of plants and trees, the mycelial network seems to have some of the same, at least, form properties as neural networks.
Yeah, but
have,
that's right? Theoretically, and I'm interested at the woman who gave this experience. What truth value from that, apart from the obvious theoretically knowledge we get on mycelium, etc., what truth value has this type of experience in philosophy or maybe science? But since you're talking about philosophy, let's start with that. How do we value such experiences?
Well, again, you can get into the metaphysics of mind with plants, which is a very interesting topic. But then, at the same time, it seems that psychedelics can seem to induce an intuition of that as well, a feeling of that, you know, directly. So I think that... there was this great paper on panpsychism by Hartshorne, this American philosopher following Whitehead. And he said one of the reasons that people think panpsychism is completely mad is because of the so-called prosaic fallacy, right? Which means that, this is a simple thing, people cannot imagine other forms of consciousness other than the prosaic normal consciousness. So at the very least, I think psychedelics can, you know, suddenly, even if you think it's real at the time, it's noetic at the time, then afterwards you think that was just obviously my LSD trip or whatever, it can at least open up questions and people more interested.
And panpsychism, to be absolutely clear, is the assumption that everything around us has some form of mentality or sentience, or so plants, but maybe also rivers or...
Well, it's interesting you get into depth there, because forms of animism believe rivers have consciousness, but not panpsychism.
Okay, maybe let's not go into that.
But to follow up on this final thing, these experiences, they help us get a more sense of that truth that we cannot experience without it. Do you actually think that when we use psychedelics in this way and we have these kind of experiences, that we will become better people?
Ooh, that's, you know, this is...
Put it in the drinking water, we would say.
I mean, this is where Nietzsche comes in, you know, what does better mean? It's hard for me to say that. There's two interesting counterpoints to that. One is that I think that it certainly seems, with nature connectedness, it seems to increase your valuation of nature, which can be certainly ethical in this sense today. At the same time, people like Octavio Paz and Marcuse even, and so on, they say that psychedelics, and Bertrand Russell, interestingly, about mysticism, say that these states take one beyond good and evil, it meant like beyond your culture's ideology of what is right.
Enlightened position, I guess.
So there's two sides to that, really. And it's,
you know, why are you a bit doubtful about the word enlightened? Because you were nodding your head sideways when...
Oh, I don't know, really. It's some kind of subconscious thing.
Okay.
Nice.
I'm in favor of the enlightened mind. I mean, you know, there was this talk actually at Exeter from Jules Evans the other day about how there's this slight danger if you say that, you know, you've become enlightened with psychedelics, that can feed into eugenics to a certain extent. You know, there's a hierarchy of humans.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is fair, really. But it's, another interesting ethical debate to be had, and where philosophers are needed, really. Yeah.
Well, and it is interesting that certain traditions using psychedelics, or at least modern ways of using psychedelics, have always have often led to derailings and strange stuff happening, and people believing in their own truth and somehow becoming totalistic. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is why I always suggest psychedelics plus philosophy. You know, for
metaphysics. Boring metaphysics needs to be...
Because it can get out of hand.
One final question from the audience, if there is one. Let me see.
Yes, here at front. Oh, and there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Sjöstedt. I wonder what is the relationship between this body of knowledge that you were describing, thank you very much for the summary, by the way, and the traditional religious beliefs where the psychedelics is an essential part of it, for example, in Latin America, because it feels like we are trying to Columbus something that already exists and discover it for the West in a fetishized, simplified way. Thank you.
Well, there is a history of European use of psychedelics, which goes back thousands of years as well. So it's not it's not restricted to the Americas. In fact, you find it all over the world, number one. Number two, it's very interesting. And like I say, there are ethical questions regarding appropriation, reduction, and so on, which we're working on. In the PG certificate, we've got classes on decolonization, for example. But what interests me the most is we have a class on Native American metaphysics. And here we try to combine views of animism induced by psychedelics with Western views. And remember, there's no Western view that colonized. I mean, Spinoza here, as you probably know living here, he was excommunicated by his fellow Jews, and his books were banned by the church. And for 100 years after his death, if you said you're a Spinozist, you would lose everything, It was a very dangerous thing to say. So there are many strands in the West, and there are many strands in the rest of the world. So it's you can't really reduce one to the other. But that makes it a very interesting topic. Yeah.
Somehow, reflecting also on this conversation wrapping up, I can't help but think that also with the full room here and the growing interest in the topic, there seems to be a growing awareness of the topics that you raise. Do you see that as well? And if you do, why do you think it's happening?
Well, academically, I think it's because I think at the end of the 20th century, people thought they'd pretty much worked out what consciousness was, that it didn't exist, or if it did exist, it was just an epiphenomenon of brain states. That didn't work out, so we're like, what the hell is it then? If this didn't work out, That's one reason. A second reason is we realized that a lot of the sort of messages about psychedelics from late 1960s onwards were false, probably propaganda. But I think there's something deeper as well, which is that, the question of consciousness and psychedelics, how it relates to consciousness, of course, a question about yourself, your own mind, your own self. And if you don't really know the answer to this mind-matter mystery, you're not fully self-conscious. You don't fully understand yourself, none of us do. So I think there's this kind of metaphysical, Schopenhauer, who's an atheist, he wrote about this metaphysical need in all people. And also another part of that is, I think, established religions have become kind of
if it's a powerful need. Sorry to interrupt you, but if it's a need in all people, it doesn't explain why it's now. And the void that you seem to describe seems to be something of the now. There seems to be a crisis of meaning somehow. Is this surge in interest related to that, you think?
I think there are many factors. I mean, meaning crisis we have, I think is related to the existentialism, of course, of the 20th century. So is it something new? I'm not sure. But I think there's just a general need to understand the mind, ourselves, and our relationship to nature. And that's something probably natural, as we are part of nature. So I think it's just a part of sort of developing self-consciousness, ultimately.
An awakening, maybe, of sorts.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I think. Or do you have another question? I think it's a great wrap-up, right?
It's great. Thank
you. Delving into our mind and nature.
Fijn dat je luisterde naar Future Affairs. En vind je dit onderwerp, dat mysterie van bewustzijn, nou interessant? Luister dan vooral ook de voorgaande afleveringen in deze serie. We gaan met filosofen, hersenwetenschappers, mensen uit de kwantumfysica gesprekken aan over wat zij denken dat de aard van ons bewustzijn is. Aflevering 3 gaat ook over psychedelica met Michiel van Elk, een onderzoeker in Leiden, die toch alweer hele andere antwoorden geeft op die vraag. Dus voorlopig houdt deze vraag ons nog wel even bezig. Ik ga er ook nog wel eens op door in mijn nieuwsbrief Future Affairs. Vind je dat nou interessant? Abonneer je dan via www.nrc.nl/futureaffairs.